Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
For some soon-to-be retirees, those last few weeks and months of work may feel a bit like high school senioritis, or maybe just senioritis, ready to get on with the next stage. But if you're the U.S. Defense Secretary, the last days before retirement aren't for wrapping things up or taking it easy. They're for chewing out NATO. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a program in which rates are determined by the driving habits of policyholders. Learn more at Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and for Kai Rizdahl, thanks for joining us on this Friday, TGIF. It is the 10th day of June. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is on a worldwide farewell tour before his retirement at the end of the month, and he is not fading softly into the background. During a speech today in Brussels, Gates fired off a warning about scarce financial support from Europe for NATO. Without more money, he said, the alliance faces a dim future and risks, quote, military irrelevance. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has more from Washington.
Secretary Gates said NATO's air war against Libya's Muammar Gaddafi has exposed just how poor the North Atlantic alliance has become. Instead of the anticipated 300 flights a day over Libya, NATO is struggling to launch 150.
Furthermore, the mightiest military alliance in history is only 11 weeks into an operation against a poorly armed regime in a sparsely populated country. Yet many allies are beginning to run short of munitions, requiring the U.S. once more to make up the difference.
Gates warned that with its own financial woes, the U.S. has little appetite for keeping up its nearly 75% share of NATO's budget. He said only 5 of the 28 allies are spending the minimum required by NATO for military readiness.
He certainly was extremely blunt. I call it a verbal shock and awe.
Heather Connolly at the Center for Strategic and International Studies says Europe's military spending has been falling for 10 years.
The impact of the European sovereign debt crisis is really starting to put into stark contrast. Is it debt or defense? I wouldn't be surprised if you're going to hear some of those echoes in our own debate here in Washington.
Gates did praise oil-rich Norway for contributing more than its share for the Libyan airstrikes, but the Oslo government today cut back the number of its F-16s over Libya and said it would pull out entirely by August 1st. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Turkey holds elections this Sunday, and the party that's run the country for the past decade is widely expected to win another term. The AKP party is Islamic-leaning and is popular in large part because of what it has done for the economy. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports from Istanbul.
For years, Istanbul taxi driver Lokman Mutlu voted for right-wing parties. But this time, the AKP is going to get his vote. He says the party's helped him get health insurance for his two kids and given them free school books. And when Turkey does well, he says his business does too. That's exactly what the AKP wants people to say. The party's election ads and other campaign materials all point up the economic improvements the government has made since it was first elected in 2002. Better health care, better infrastructure, better control of inflation. And it promises even more progress if it gets reelected. Ali Çarkoğlu is a political scientist at Koç University in Istanbul. He says you can see the effects the economic improvements are having on regular Turks.
This actually improves the lifestyle of the people on the street quite significantly. I mean, Turks are not used to this kind of consumption, but I think we are enjoying it.
Even so, after almost 10 years of rapid economic growth, some are afraid Turkey is due for a crash. And they wonder whether the AKP can maintain its zeal for modernizing the country economically and socially. If the country is going to keep attracting the outside investment that's been so crucial to its prosperity, the party will have to continue with these liberalizing policies. In Istanbul, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a sixth week of losses for the Dow and the S&P 500. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke spoke out about the economy earlier this week. If you've noticed, things have been slowing down a bit. He says not to worry, but to suss out what's really going on with the Fed and all the other business news of the past 5 days, we're going to do our weekly wrap on Wall Street and beyond. And for that, we have Bloomberg's Lizzie O'Leary in our bureau in Washington, D.C., and Felix Salmon, who blogs for Reuters in New York. Hey, guys.
Hi, Tess.
Hi.
Lizzie, let's start with you. The Fed chairman said this slowdown is a bit of a hiccup due to bad weather and the earthquake in Japan. He says things are going to pick up. Is he delivering the right message here?
Well, if you look at what the stock market did this week, they don't seem to have that much confidence in his remarks. Although I do think he gets the award for sort of the no-duh Fed chair remark of the century, which is the job situation remains far from normal. No kidding. I mean, obviously, that's going to drive a lot of things. It's going to drive whether or not people spend, and it drives the overall sense of confidence that people, even those who aren't actively invested in the stock market, have in the economy.
Right. Felix?
What I'm worried about is that the job situation is going to become normal because no one seems to care anymore. Everyone's going on and on and on about the budget deficit and the national debt. You know, Bernanke started talking about fiscal policy at some length, which is quite rare for a Fed chairman, and no one's talking about job creation. And if we don't create new jobs, this is going to be a normal job situation, and that's going to be devastating for the economy.
Well, Lizzie, as Felix says, everybody's been talking about cutting the deficit. But then this week we had renewed concern over this slowdown prompting Democrats to call for another stimulus.
And that's pretty much a non-starter when you do the political math in Washington. You might see some smaller targeted things. The White House started to float the idea of a payroll tax cut again for employers, and some Democrats might get on board with that on the Hill, but sort of never underestimate the political calculus of an election year. It does make it hard to move things, but this is a serious problem, and they've got two serious problems they're facing.
Mm-hmm. Felix, should stimulus be anywhere on the table?
Absolutely. We desperately need a second stimulus because the first one is running out. And one of the things we're seeing with these slowdown in the GDP figures and the recalcitrantly high unemployment figures is precisely the way in which our first round of stimulus hasn't been enough. So we do need more. And honestly, in an election year, this is what governments all around the world do, is they spend money to buy votes. I don't quite understand why we can't do that here, because it's desperately needed.
They seem to have adopted the idea that fighting debt is more politically popular than job creation. It's a very complicated piece of political math.
But where are they thinking that that comes from? I mean, who would want to fight the deficit over giving people jobs?
Well, the Republican line is that we've already tried a stimulus. It didn't really work. And therefore, let's cut back on debt. I suspect if you see the unemployment rate tick up again in the next couple of months, that's going to be harder to have any real popular support behind it, because it starts to feel out of touch.
Well, Lizzie, real quick, I know you've been covering the floods in the Midwest and the South, part of a whole slew of environmental disasters over the last few months, tornadoes, fires. How are we going to pay for all this?
Oh, the bill is coming. I think there will be two things. One, the National Flood Insurance Program, which is already, you know, $18 billion in debt to the Treasury. We're never going to see that again. But the other thing, one of the guys told me there who helps do shipping on the Mississippi, is that's an economic indicator. Whatever happens there happens 2 or 3 months before it happens in the rest of the country. And that's not good. That means the money waves will keep hitting.
Felix, how damaging is this to any chance for an economic recovery?
The weather? I think the weather, it comes and it goes. I mean, unless you have a sort of Japan-style tsunami, it doesn't have a massive long-term economic effect. But it certainly doesn't help. And right now, we need all of the help we can get.
All right. Bloomberg's Lizzie O'Leary and Felix Salmon of Reuters joining us live for the weekly wrap. Thanks so much, guys. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Seth.
Thank you.
For a retailer specializing in downward dog wear, Lululemon is trending upward in just about every other way. The Canadian yoga and activewear company reported stronger than expected earnings today. Meanwhile, many of its U.S. rivals are struggling to regain pricing power with consumers. Sally Herships looks at what the niche retailer will have to do to keep up its warrior pose.
Yoga positions can be challenging, and so can yoga prices. A pair of Lululemon's popular groove pants runs over $100. Mary Lou Quinlan is CEO of Just Ask a Woman, a marketing company specializing in female consumer behavior. She says Lululemon can command high prices because it's an aspirational brand in a category that used to be practical.
The real reason, the whole truth of why women buy it, gorgeous fashionability, the cachet of looking like a really cool workout person, and the fact that that terrific fabric makes your butt look good.
Lululemon has stretched its product line well beyond the yoga studio to jackets, underwear, and hats, but it's kept corporate waistlines trim through careful growth.
If you actually look at the footprint of the company, it's tiny.
Shirasu Karmi is founder of Launch Collective, a retail industry consulting firm.
So they have 81 stores in the U.S., and if you compare it to something like J. Crew, who has 300 stores, not to mention Gap, that has 3,000, see that the growth opportunity is enormous.
Karmi says the yoga apparel industry is worth about $6 billion a year. But she says Lululemon is well poised to grab a bigger share of the $15 billion market for all types of women's activewear. The company's employees are living advertisements for the brand.
They go to yoga classes together. They have this sort of culture of activewear, of wellness around it that then extends into the customer.
Lululemon says it's planning to open 30 stores in the U.S. and Canada by the end of this year. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
About 5 years ago, Marketplace traveled to China for a series of stories looking at the rise of an economic powerhouse. Today, China is the number two economy in the world, and multinational corporations are rushing there to ride its growth. Kai is back in the Middle Kingdom, and for the past 2 weeks, he's been collecting stories and blogging online about how that economy is doing. He sent us this postcard.
You can come here and talk to all the experts you want to try to figure out what's going on in the Chinese economy, and we have. But the way this country works, the only way you're actually going to get a good sense of it is to get out and about. Really get out and about. And that explains how I came to be riding the number 113 Chongqing City bus on a long, hot, sweaty hour-and-a-half ride home from work the other day with a guy named Li Yongqin. Li's 36 years old. He's married. He's got two little boys, for which he paid heavy fines, by the way. One for being born out of wedlock. The second for being, well, the second. His wife, Cheng Jia Sheng, doesn't cut the kids much slack. Even a visit by a Chinese-speaking foreigner becomes a maternally directed learning opportunity.
Okay. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Li owns his own place. He owns two apartments, actually. One that he rents out. He's got his own business, construction contracting. So by pretty much every indicator, he's in the rising Chinese middle class. Makes about $1,000 US a month, maybe a little bit more. He puts half of that, at least, in the bank, though. Because, and here's the not-so-good part, he knows firsthand that it could all go bad like that. His wife, Cheng Jia Sheng, got hurt at work a month ago. A commercial mixer in the baking company she was trying to start up took a chunk out of her arm. 3 days in the hospital and $4,500 in doctor's bills later. That is almost half the family's income for the whole year. She's still laid up. And therein, says longtime China watcher Paul French, lies the biggest problem with what's happening in this country right now, economic boom or no economic boom.
What needs to happen is the country needs to get a social safety net in place. It needs to have a health service and a pension service. And it doesn't have to be a national health service. It can be an insurance-based system. There has to be some kind of system that lets people know that when they get sick, they can go to a hospital. That when they get old, that there will be some money there for them to get some help.
Our China series goes on the air with the Lees and a whole bunch more in early July. I'm back in L.A. on Monday.
And that little boy Kai was talking to, he said, surprise, surprise, that when he grows up, he wants to be a rich man. There is more on Kai's blog at marketplace.org. Coming up, are you noticing more bikes on the road?
I think there's something in the air. People are definitely more interested in bike riding than ever before.
And that means the advertisers are too. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow plunged 172 points today, 1.4% to close at 11,951. The Nasdaq dropped 41 points, 1.5% to finish at 2643. The S&P 500 lost 18 points, 1.4% to end the day at 1270. For the week, the Dow fell 1.6%, the Nasdaq unplugged 3.3%, the S&P 500 lost 2.2%. Oil prices sank under $100 a barrel today after Saudi Arabia said it'll increase production. Chevron, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil all spilled about 1.5%. Toyota Motor skidded down 1.5% as well after the automaker said operating profit could fall by almost a third this year because of the recent earthquake and tsunami in Japan. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.97%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. And by The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them on newsstands, Android smartphones, and at The Economist online. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Farmers Insurance, trained local agents committed to small business success. More at 1-866-200-4BIZ. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Current top contenders for the Republican nomination for president debate the issues in New Hampshire. Secretary General of the United Nations Ban Ki-moon turns 67. And on June 13, 1966, the U.S. Supreme Court established the Miranda Warning. Suspects must be informed of their rights before statements can be taken by police. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Today, the Japanese government reprimanded the Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, for allowing two of its workers to be exposed to dangerous levels of radiation after the earthquake. Nuclear safety officials ordered an investigation and told the operator of the Fukushima plant to find ways to reduce risks to employees. It's been 3 months since the earthquake and resulting tsunami struck Japan, and the after effects are still rippling through the country's economy. Joining us to discuss Japan's recovery efforts is David Weinstein. He's Associate Director of Research at the Center on the Japanese Economy and Business, part of the Columbia Business School. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me here.
So here we are, 3 months after the big earthquake. How is Japan's economy recovering?
Well, Japan's economy is recovering quite nicely, and most probably by the second half of this year, we'll see some pretty strong growth numbers coming out of Japan.
There was a lot of talk right after this happened that Japan was basically going to be able to fund its own recovery. Has that happened?
Yeah, one has to remember that Japan is a relatively wealthy economy, and Japan responded quite aggressively to the earthquake and tsunami and nuclear crisis. It had a very rapid supplementary budget passed through the Diet that stimulated a lot of economic activity. The mm-hmm. Bank of Japan stepped in to help out companies. And I think that these measures are working in helping Japanese firms to get back on their feet.
Just before the quake, the Japanese prime minister was set to promote a trade agreement with the U.S., but of course that was put on the back burner. How are trade pacts then a factor in the recovery?
Well, I think this is going to be one of the big long-term impacts. Prime Minister Kan was a very big advocate for the Trade Pact of the Pacific, which was a multilateral trade agreement among Pacific Rim countries. And Once the earthquake hit, he obviously had to turn his attention to the domestic crisis, and he couldn't push this agenda forward. And obviously that creates a potential problem for Japan if the United States ends up signing a variety of trade partnerships with Japan's competitors.
We've heard a lot about the effect on the supply chain worldwide with so much manufacturing coming out of China. How has that turned out? Has it turned out to be as bad as folks thought it might be?
In the short run, it was quite bad indeed. Japanese car production fell by almost 50% as a result of this. And that largely reflects the fact that when you're doing assembly, if even a small component doesn't arrive, you can't sell the finished product. But what we're seeing is that Japanese plants have been coming back online. About 90% of the affected plants are now functional again. And so I think that while we'll see some really bad numbers, and we have seen some bad numbers over the last month and this month, probably by July that'll have largely passed.
You know, it's remarkable listening to you talk about what things are like over there. I would never have imagined that 3 months out it would be as recovered as it is.
Well, one of the interesting things that one observes in looking at catastrophic events in developed countries is that very often the human toll can be quite catastrophic, but economies are fairly robust and usually come back after a couple of months.
But what you're talking about with Japan is entire communities, entire swaths of land wiped out.
Right. But while it was catastrophic in those regions tended to be fairly rural areas. And one is also seeing an influx of new people coming into those areas to help rebuild and start up new companies in the wake of those places that have been destroyed.
David Weinstein is Associate Director of Research at the Center on Japanese Economy and Business at the Columbia Business School. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
New bike lanes in many U.S. cities have boosted the popularity of wheels and spokes as a way to get around town. And now that trend is working its way into advertising. Some retailers that usually sell sofas, shoes, purses are now adding a new item to their lines, bikes. From the Transportation Nation Project at WNYC, Andrea Bernstein has the story.
In the Soho neighborhood of New York City, bikes are popping up everywhere, not just on the green bike lanes that run through the area, but in the window displays. This season, bikes have shown up in shoe stores, dress shops, in front of fancy hotels. And you can even buy a bike at CB2, the chic younger sibling of Crate and Barrel. The large showroom has stylish outdoor furniture, bright orange sofas, red bamboo plates. And there are two solid gray bicycles with big yellow tires and bright red leather seats.
They certainly will jump out at you with the yellow tires.
Marty Schultz is retired. He came here to buy kitchen stools and says he isn't in the market for a bike. But he likes what he sees.
It sort of gives me an impression I'm going to see a lot of modern stuff as I walk through here.
Martha Calle, brand director of CB2, says she's always looking for big current trends.
We live in Chicago, and on our drive-in, because we do drive-in, we have noticed that our commute is getting longer and longer because the amount of people biking in the city is incredible.
To promote greener and healthier transportation, mayors in pretty much every large city have installed thousands of miles of bike lanes in recent years, and all those cities have seen a surge in bike commuting. For CB2's Marta Calle, the clincher was seeing tons of cyclists at a design conference in Milan, Italy.
And we thought, what a cool trend. It speaks to our customer because our customer is young at heart.
You can spot it in recent issues of almost any fashion magazine, long-legged models posing with bikes as props. And a number of non-bike retailers are selling bikes this season. Club Monaco, Urban Outfitters, Anthropologie. Then there's the high-end purse and fashion company, Kate Spade. Kyle Andrew is a senior VP.
I think there's something in the air. People are definitely more interested in bike riding than ever before.
Outside Kate Spade's flagship store in Lower Manhattan, Andrew points to a window displaying wedding items. There are some sleek white purses, elegant white dresses, and a white bike. Dangling on the handlebars is a bright pink sign that says, "Just Married." It's all directed at what Andrew refers to as the Kate Spade girl.
Even if she's wearing a beautiful Kate Spade dress and high-heeled shoes, she's still going to get on her bike and go across town because she loves adventure and loves exploring, and that's just her spirit.
Bikes have come to connote coolness, urbanity, and romance, according to Sharon Davis. She's a senior executive at the advertising firm BBDO. Even, she says, in places where bike lanes have faced criticism, everyone still loves bikes.
Sometimes it's a metaphor. Sometimes it can be an archetype.
Davis says advertisers are trying to transfer the halo effect of biking to their own products. But she says all that marketing can also end up promoting biking, not just shoes or sofas.
It becomes part of a bigger story of one's life.
Except that next year, the retailers we spoke with said they'll be off bikes and on to the next big thing. From New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
And to see photo gallery of how bikes are now marketed on the streets of New York City, visit us at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. By Manta, connecting millions of small business owners with new customers every day. On the web at manta.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, the show will go on. Broadway's Tony Awards are set for this Sunday, but only today did producers reach an agreement with the Stagehands Union over staffing for the red carpet. The dispute was the result of moving the show from Radio City Music Hall to the smaller Beacon Theater. The Beacon's red carpet rests one block outside a perimeter guaranteeing union jobs. But now it will be staffed with union members. Let the real drama begin. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow plunged 172 points, 1.4%. The Nasdaq dropped 41 points, 1.5%. And the S&P 500 lost 18 points, 1.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is JJ Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, has the adjustable rate mortgage gotten a bad rap?
Not all ARM products are bad. I mean, we can just say that right out front.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Have a great weekend. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.